The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions' world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. For better or for worse, the franchise film provides much of the lifeblood for theatrical horror releases. But reboots, sequels, prequels, and reimaginings are a tricky business. You want to give the people what they want, what they liked about the original that encouraged them to come see the follow-up, but you want to give them something more, something a little bit different, to give them the satisfaction of a new movie-going experience. It really is a fine tightrope to walk. It's rare to come out and create a franchise. They happen organically. If you set out to create one, chances are it will tank. The successful horror franchises came from individual self-contained movies, films that did not look into the commercial future of their deadly spawn. But when the original film is a hit, particularly in the hands of a major studio, at least one sequel is pretty much guaranteed. Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, Hellraiser, The Purge, Scream, all of them were created without intending to build a commercial empire. I've worked on several projects with numbers in the title, The Fly 2, Critters 2, Psycho 4, and the Freddy's Nightmares series, and have walked that tightrope many times with varying success. But there's something special about Halloween. In 1982, producers John Carpenter and Deborah Hill wanted to do something completely different with their property. They wanted to do something completely different every year, a Halloween story that jettisoned Laurie Strode, Michael Myers, and Dr. Loomis. It would have been an annual spook show with Halloween as the umbrella title and theme, but an original tale every time out. Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, was the first and last Halloween movie to try it. And the dissatisfaction among the fans led to a disappointing box office and a return to Haddonfield from then on, and a cult resurgence in years to come. It's a fascinating story and one we're going to learn all about from its writer-director, Tommy Lee Wallace, after this. Are you a horror screenwriter looking for your big break? ScreenCraft can help you get there. This year, ScreenCraft's horror screenwriting competition brings horror heavyweights to its jury, including writer-director-showrunner Mike Flanagan of the hit Netflix shows Midnight Mass, The Haunting of Hill House, and The Haunting of Bly Manor. Dubbed the industry's number one horror screenplay contest by IndieWire, the ScreenCraft Horror Competition has a long history of creating success for its winners and finalists, many of whom have gone on to sign at places like Bellevue Productions, Kaplan Perrone, Affirmative Entertainment, Zero Gravity, and more. Winners will be accepted into the ScreenCraft Development Program and receive personal introductions and phone calls with top Hollywood literary managers who are looking for talented, emerging film and TV screenwriters. So whether you're writing a contained, socially relevant horror movie or a big horror TV series, ScreenCraft's jury wants to read your script. Head over to screencraft.org/horror to enter your feature screenplay or TV pilot. Act fast, the competition closes on Halloween, October 31st. Where's Mike Myers? It was the outcry that sank an entire movie. When Halloween 3 hit the theaters, it had all the promise of a smash hit. Talent, dedication, gripping story, and two predecessors in a budding anthology that broke the box office to smithereens. There was only one problem. In this movie, everyone's favorite murderer was nowhere to be found. The backlash was swift and brutal. Halloween 3, once so promising, slunk in and out of theaters, leaving behind a trail of outraged fans and a team of bewildered filmmakers asking themselves, what happened? Acclaimed horror director Tommy Lee Wallace has a few answers. In his debut book, Halloween 3, Where the Hell is Michael Myers?, Wallace offers a beautiful, poignant, often hilarious, in-depth account of how H3 came to be, revisiting the triumphs and pitfalls of being a first-time director and the heartache in watching it all fall down, only to be rocked 40 years later by the discovery that the dedicated fandom for his box office flop has been there all along. But of course, what's horror without a twist ending? With a foreword by Tom Atkins, your very own Dan Challis, never-before-seen set photos, and inspirational artwork from you, the fans, Halloween 3, Where the Hell is Michael Myers? Is a talisman for both horror fans and folks who love a damn fine story. This book is for the ones who always knew. So, Tommy, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Tell me, this is a very unusual sequel in that it did decide to just jump in. But you were offered Halloween 2 first, were you not?
Yes, I was briefly on board as the director of Halloween 2. The conflict came when John turned in the script. I was all over the original Halloween, you could say the third part of that team, if I may be so bold as to presume that.
Oh yeah, you had a number of roles on that, not just including Michael Myers in the scene in the closet.
And other scenes as well. Uh-huh. But it took a great deal of pride in that movie, and I thought it was the classiest horror movie we knew we'd done a scary film. Of course, we had no idea it would turn into the phenomenon that it did, but somehow the script, when John did it, he did it kind of on the fly, under pressure. I'm talking about Halloween 2, and he and I didn't spend a lot of time talking about it. I briefly advocated for a 5 years later type of sequel. I thought there was a lot of content to be worked with around the idea that Laurie Strode has been traumatized beyond PTSD and is trying to live her life and goes off to some very secure small college somewhere with great trepidation. And of course, any maximum security kind of situation can turn equally into a prison. And there you have basically the plot of H2O.
Right.
So I was kind of advocating for that, but John felt his instincts told him to do a 5 minutes later type sequel. And anybody who's worked with John understands that his instincts are very good. So yeah. I respected that. And of course, it turned out to be a great success at the box office. But I couldn't hide the fact that when John turned in the script, I just hated it. I hated it. It felt like the anti-Halloween because of all the gore. And of course, he was up against the fact that H2 was not an immediate sequel. At least two years went by before H2 came out. And in that time, there'd been a sort of arms race of violence and gore in horror movies. And so I think he simply felt like in order to compete in the marketplace, that he needed to do that. Anyway, drawing out a very long story, the end of that part of this story is that I just said, really, I can't direct this in all good conscience, because I think it would have been a false note to begin my own directing career on. I know I could have done a good job, but it would have been, I'd have been faking it. And John and Deborah deserved a director who was really gung-ho and loved the script and wanted to give it his best. So I withdrew, and I felt horrible about it and felt like also it was like okay, is this career suicide? Here's an opportunity to direct on a silver platter, and I'm walking
to away. Do your first feature and for a major studio, because yeah. The original Halloween was a small indie Compass International production, became the most successful independent film of all time, highest grossing. And then here's your opportunity.
Oh yeah, it was on a platter, and I knew it was the wrong move for me. So I withdrew, but Deborah then called me the next year. I think they had Joe Dante on board briefly. And he went on to something else, and that opened the door to someone else. And I was pleasantly surprised when I was invited on board to do this. My first reaction when Deborah called, her words were something like, how do you feel about directing Halloween 3? Well, after Halloween 2, I figured, okay, it's just going to be mega gore and just stupidity. And so I started to say no thanks, but she hastened to add, it's all new, it's all going to be different. No shape, no babysitters, no big knife, starting over from scratch with a whole new idea. And I went, count me in. You know, I was delighted. And it's also a tribute to our friendship and lasting respect, not only Deborah and me, but John and me as well. We go back a long way.
Yeah, you're both from Bowling Green, Kentucky. Did you come out together?
No, John came first. I helped him blaze that trail because he was looking for he had known since childhood that he wanted to be a film director, which was going to involve film school. And so I knew about this book in the library on the campus of the college in our town, where you could go and look. It was called the Blue Book, I think, and a list of colleges all over the country. And we looked at NYU and Miami and USC. And he chose USC, and I think it probably enjoys the deepest and longest reputation as film schools go, except maybe for London Film School. But so I helped him make up his mind, and off he went. And we continued to correspond while I went off to art school in Ohio. And the picture he painted of the scene, West Coast scene, you know, Dear Tommy, I was out on Sunset Boulevard and walked past the whiskey and the Doors were playing inside. And it's like, oh my God, this just sounds like Eden, you know? And so I was pretty attracted toward the West Coast. So when I graduated, I had a portfolio full of graphic design kind of stuff. It was either going to be New York or Los Angeles. And because John was already there, I went out with a couple of friends, spring break, a borrowed car, and just went to an interview in the film department, and the animation guy was interested in my portfolio. So I got accepted. In effect, John had one foot out the door as I was entering the front door. And so he and Dan O'Bannon were already plotting to expand their student film, Dark Star,
right,
into a feature. And so I helped him out with that.
You were a production designer on that, right?
Well, no, that honor went to Dan. I was kind of his right-hand man. I was the first guy who showed up who could really do a professional job on signage, for example, and right, all the myriad tasks that pop up in the art department. And he trusted me, and so we got along very well.
Painting the beach ball.
Actually, Dan painted the beach ball.
Ah, okay.
Dan was a madman. He was a brilliant guy, full of ideas. Now, he and John made a formidable team. But Dan was not easy to work with. So the fact that he liked me and we fit together allowed him to designate and delegate many tasks, you know, building the elevator shaft, for example, or creating that zany xylophone-like instrument that Brian Norell plays in one scene. He was able to just say, hey, go do that, and knew he could trust me to pull something passable off. So it was a fun learning time. USC is a marvelous school, and I learned a lot there, as have a lot of other folks. But having a movie, you're participating in an actual movie, is a bigger education by far, to just be there doing stuff and picking up information as you go. And, oh, drop that and go help Doug Knapp do a lighting. You know, you just soaking up information and skills and techniques all along the way. It was a great education.
That's wonderful. Yeah, I never got the opportunity to do film school and always wished I'd had, but, you know, we enter through different portals.
Yes, indeed.
So I know your early career was deeply intertwined with John's, but we'll get back to that. But as far as Halloween 3 goes, how did it begin? I know Nigel Neal, who wrote the Quatermass movies, was involved and had written a draft or two early on, because John was such a huge fan of the Quatermass films. How did that transpose or metamorphose into what became Season of the Witch?
Well, I suppose we should start with the elevator pitch, which I believe was Deborah's for Halloween 3, when they decided they'd had enough of the shape, they'd had enough of the big knife and the babysitters. And so if they were going to be on board, and this train was leaving the station one way or another, they insisted it was going to have to be a departure of some sort. And Deborah came up, I believe it was Deborah's brainchild, how about witchcraft meets the computer age? And that's a pretty good pitch. And I believe that's what she handed off to Nigel, who was a much respected writer in science fiction and horror and many other genres as well. And so, yes, indeed, Nigel, by the time I came on board, Joe Dante, also a Nigel Neal fan, had come and gone. And Nigel turned in the script. I think his marching orders were just, hey, do something with that theme. And although they had shown him Halloween 1 and Halloween 2, and reportedly he didn't think much of either movie, he went away and came back with a script that it had much to offer. And people asked me many times how much of Nigel was left in the script by the time you finished the movie. And I have to say at least 50 or 60% of the finished film.
Wow.
Is Nigel's characters, his plot. The fact that he took his name off of it is a long conversation. I think I've spoken with his biographer, a man named Andy Murray. Mm-hmm. And Andy, we went back and forth about this because for several years there, I had operated under the misconception that Nigel had quit on us, in effect. He turned in a script, unbeknownst to me at that point, it was like his second or third draft. I thought it was his first draft. And typically after a first draft, as you well know, you're going to be in for notes, and there are several people going to weigh in, and you're going to have to fight certain battles and win some and lose some and keep on writing. So I thought that was what we were looking at. And then he just said, no, his statements later indicated that he thought these young punks were about to desecrate his masterpiece, or words to that effect.
Right.
So I wasn't very kind to him through interviews. We never had words about it at all. But when he withdrew abruptly, it dropped into my lap and John's lap to do something with a script that, although it was very interesting and strange, and the central idea, which survives, was really scary and quite terrifying. Not a particularly original idea that there is an evil force out to destroy the world. That wasn't the original part, but the original part was, okay, it's Halloween time and masks, and the target is the children. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Those are things that were all Nigel, and they were in there. I suppose to clarify what then was wrong, Nigel is and was an acknowledged master of a certain type of presentation. You could say that the original script was perfect for one of the original Rod Serling Twilight Zone episodes, or British television of the 50s, a psychodrama.
Right.
It focused a great deal on a kind of Freudian story involving young Ellie, the damsel, let's say, and her father, a sort of tangled story about an abusive father, a bird that was given to her as a gift when she was a child, and she let the bird go, and her father beat her. And so there's this tortured narrative that goes down through Nigel's script about all of that, which sets up his climax, in which Ellie has been reduced to the mentality of a child, presumably through mind control or something.
Well, that sounds like a good time at the movies, right?
Well, you know, it was disturbing and it was well written. It was though as if Nigel had never seen a contemporary American horror flick, roller coaster movie designed for young people.
Right. Yeah,
that was part of the gap that we were having to grapple with. It was just as if he'd been in a museum somewhere for a long time.
Mm.
Okay, so I think that John took a pass. And John has John's a musician, after all, first and foremost. And
as you are as well.
Yeah, thank you. And so John first added pace and all the tricks of suspense and immediacy that he's well known for. And then I rewrote him. He may have been a little surprised at that, but I rewrote him. And he respected that too. John was a great producer. You can imagine that situation could be intimidating for a director, especially a first-time director. But yeah. John stayed clear of the production pretty much. He was there in support if I needed to consult. But
you are the one credited with the screenplay.
Well, John never added his name. He's probably rewritten every script he's ever shot,
right,
on his own pictures without putting his name on them. So it was not surprising to me that he would just slip me the script and didn't expect any credit for it, or blame, whichever you wish to apply. But that was how I wound up with the most inaccurate credit ever given to anyone.
It's good for residuals.
Well, that's true. But, you know, it should have. If I'd been thinking clearly at the time, I would have put an Alan Smithy kind of credit on it. You're familiar with that term?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's when
traditionally, first started with directors and then writers started using it to indicate, okay, if you see Alan Smithy in the title, that means somebody took their name off.
Exactly.
Somebody was dissatisfied or that felt their work was desecrated in some way. That would have been a more accurate way of going about it. Or
although you were the writer and director, and own it.
That's exactly what John said when I started writing the book this year that'll be released October 31st. He said, own your movie, you know, reclaim your movie.
Especially now that people love it so much. I mean, I've had projects that did not do well in their early days and have ended up being really close and near and dear to the hearts of the fans. This is one of those.
Feels good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'll tell you, Mick, the redemption for Halloween 3 has been very sweet. It hurt badly when it was perceived as a failure. And I say perceived because I looked back at the figures. It didn't do that badly. Its first time out, it was about 16 million as compared to Halloween 2, which made about 20 something million in its opening barrage. So it was not a failure at all. It was just the expectations were through the roof.
Right.
And the fundamental mistake, really a sort of two-part mistake that we all made, and I place blame all the way across the board from the executives at Universal, the marketing team, advertising, all those folks, plus the producers and myself. It was like, what were we thinking putting a Roman numeral 3 on a movie that was supposed to be the kickoff of an anthology?
Right.
We could have simply called it Halloween, Season of the Witch, and a big ad campaign that said, okay, fans, something totally different this year. I even, for my book, I wrote a mock ad, an as-if ad for the movie's release that might have helped, you know?
Because an all-new story for Halloween from the makers of blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. And as it was, the poster, which is a beautiful piece of artwork, all it said that might have enlightened people, laugh, was a little banner way in the corner, tiny type, that said, all new.
Whatever that means. Yeah, well.
So it was a horrendous mistake, but clearly 40 years later, it's especially the last 10 years, it's just remarkable, the fan base for this movie. It's really gratifying. And
happy 40th anniversary. I mean, I had that... As a writer of Hocus Pocus, that movie did not do well when it came out, and it is ubiquitous. And
sweet redemption.
It is indeed.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about the process. You'd gone through film school, and what USC in particular does well is train you in every department.
It does.
You'll operate camera, you'll do sound, you'll do editing. In fact, you co-edited Halloween and The Fog. But here you're directing a script that you're credited with having written for Universal Pictures.
Well, Universal actually stayed in the shadows. I think there were some union issues that caused them to want to not be prominently featured. So
it was a pickup by them officially.
They sort of shadow produced it. They backed it along with Dino De Laurentiis. There were a lot of names involved, Mustafa Akkad and Irwin Yablans and others.
From the original, yeah.
Exactly. Everybody was getting their 2 cents in. The inflation or the arms race in that world, my God, anymore. We look at the producer credits on these movies and it's like...
There's 20 of them.
Yeah, it's absurd. And there are really only two or three at most who got in the nuts and bolts and really produced the movie.
Right.
It's a kind of a catch-all credit, which dilutes it a great deal. I'm happy to say the director's credit has a little more credibility. Usually there's only one or two at the most, you know.
Well, did you feel free to fulfill your vision for the movie? Did you have... because the studio wasn't really in charge, they were picking it up. You had John and Deborah on your team, and they were a couple of 800-pound gorillas.
It was bliss, Mick. It was absolute bliss. A first-time director could not ask for a better situation. I came up through the John Carpenter School, and I must confess, I took it for granted to some degree, something that's actually quite a phenomenon. John clawed his way into control of his movies basically by offering situations where they could not refuse because he did it on the cheap. And his only conditions were, okay, but my name goes above the title and I have final cut. Well, that's a brilliant strategy and it served him well, but he sacrificed a lot to get there.
Yeah.
Well, so Dark Star, Assault on Precinct 13, Halloween, The Fog. I was accustomed to a place where the final say about what we were going to do was right there next to me in the room. It was just turned to the director and whatever he says. We're not going to have a lot of politicking and a lot of suits standing around behind us second guessing. Man, I had no idea what a luxury that was until later when I directed several other things. And it was like, what? I'm getting all this flack from behind the scenes from somebody who doesn't know how to direct a movie. And yet they think they have the right to tell me what to do. It was not an easy road. But to get back to your question, John was not much present on the movie shoot itself. And Deborah brilliantly produced it, but did not interfere with my world much at all. She weighed in very constantly on casting, and well, she might, because she really was a brilliant casting person. She had
a wonderful person and a wonderful producer.
Yeah. Rest her soul. She left us way too early.
Yeah.
But she was brilliantly supportive of me. It just spoiled me rotten for later. But and John had his hands full with the aftermath of The Thing. And right. I think he also, to credit him, I think he very wisely stayed a pretty good step away from the situation until he was needed at the end when the studio saw our finished film. And we even screened it in Las Vegas for a test screening. Las Vegas, you wonder, but it turns out that was a typical demographic sampling of the audience we needed.
It was a great place because when I was doing publicity on The Howling, we did a test screening of The Howling there that went through the roof.
Yeah, they apparently, when you got away from the strip and all the gambling and stuff, that was like a cross section of the USA.
Yeah,
very typical. But anyway, I got a call from John shortly thereafter before the release, and he said they're not happy with the ending. And I gulped, and I thought, oh, shit, here we go. It's now John, you know, I had absolute maximum respect for him as well as gratitude because I was there. At his behest and at Deborah's behest. So I was prepared for him to say, we've got to change the ending. And okay, what are we going to do? None of that happened. John said, what do you want to do? In other words, he gave me final cut on this movie.
Pretty amazing. First time out.
I knew it was a gift at the time, but after 40 years, now I know how big of a gift that was.
Yeah.
But it didn't take me but only a second to say, let's leave it the way it is. And Mick, that's a, looking back on it, it was a double whammy in a way, because not only did I believe it was the right ending for that movie, but it was also one for Don Siegel and the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure you're aware of that movie. And
sure.
the fact that it's has a bookend structure.
Yes.
It begins in an emergency room and poor old Kevin McCarthy's staggered. He's out of his mind raving about they're going to take over the world and blah, blah, blah. And then we fade back to tell the whole story of the movie. And then at the end, we flash forward back into that emergency room and, oh, a phone call goes through and, oh, it's going to be okay. We're off the hook. And I hated that bookend structure. It just instinctively.
Well, it was added. It wasn't part of the original production.
Exactly. That's what I discovered later. It was, of course you hate it because it wasn't the right thing.
Yeah.
So in a way, when John asked me what I wanted to do, some part of my answer was a blow for Don Siegel, studio interference over movies in general.
Yeah.
And to this day, I'm very proud of that ending and the way it ends. It's a horror movie. It's supposed to be scary.
And dark. Yeah.
And dark.
Now, I love the casting, and Dan O'Hurley, he is amazing in it.
Thank you.
But also the commercial, that's you.
That
You're doing the voices and the even the chipmunkized voices there.
It's true. Deborah told me, well, we've got to have a jingle, and we have no money, so you better either make something up or find something in public domain you can use and come up with a jingle. So, okay. I contacted Alan Howarth, who was collaborating with John on that soundtrack as well as others before and after, and said, let's do a session. And I went over, and first and foremost was the left hand of the synthesizer. Boom, 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 boom. And that came straight from childhood piano lessons. Everybody who's taken those lessons will remember one called the spinning song. And it goes, and the left hand is going, boom, 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 boom. So that was the beginning of it. And London Bridge, no question, that was in the public domain. So I thought, okay, that'll do. And made up the tune to go with it. London Bridge is falling down, falling down, falling down. London Bridge is falling down. What's the last line? I don't even know.
We know now, Silver Shamrock.
Silver Shamrock. Anyway, yeah, I added, harmonized with myself several times. I guess there are three or four voices or more on there. Chipmunk style, like David Seville, record slow, play back fast. And there you had it. I didn't realize at the time that it was, I knew it was the right, kind of the right feel, because it rests in that place between, if you're an adult watching this movie, you know, those little creatures singing that song are not nice people. They're little demented elves in a padded cell somewhere, and they mean you no good. They mean you only evil. However, in the story, it kind of works that the children could have been fooled by that. It's right in that little niche. And so I felt really fine about that. And just this year, a Trick or Treat studio called up. They are marketing a pumpkin that plays that thing.
Oh, how great.
That's their one of their latest releases.
That's great.
God, speaking of which, oh, may I show you a couple of items?
Sure.
Wrapping paper?
Anyone? Oh, nice. Look at that.
Believe that?
All the masks.
Yeah. Unbelievable. The
and the hat you're wearing.
Oh, yes, of course. I forgot.
Yeah. Nobody else can see it but us, but what the heck.
Yeah, and it just goes on and on, little buttons and...
The whole deal.
And then we can get to fan art. Oh, wait, that's a beautiful, beautiful T-shirt. Simple. Gets right to the point.
That's great.
Let's see. First, we'll dispense with the Trick or Treat line. Here's...
Oh, nice.
Sign that says final processing.
Restricted area for Silver Shamrock. Why do you think that its popularity has turned around? That it's been so embraced in the last decade or so?
I think there are probably two reasons. First of all, it never deserved to be slandered the way it was, because it's a pretty decent movie.
To say the least.
Here's a fan that said, look at this. Here's a T-shirt a fan laid on me. One of the, you know, cons that I go to.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, nice.
What you can see on it, it says, I wrote and directed the greatest horror film of all time. And all I got was this lousy T-shirt. The fan just came up with this The fan art is awesome. It just goes on and on and on. This just last week, somebody...
It's almost time, kids.
And it just doesn't stop. Welcome to Santa Mira.
Yeah, I mean, it's... The genre fans are the most passionate and the most embracing of all.
It's so sweet. The first time I went to a show, my buddy Sean Clark, we made it years ago, and he interviewed me and he said, you ought to do one of these shows. And I thought, hey, I don't know, just people with tattoos and piercings and like they look like psycho killers. I don't think so. And he said, no, you need to do this. And so I did one, and the people were so sweet and so supportive. I had kind of internalized the sense of failure that was laid on the original movie. And boy, you talk about getting kind of back on the horse psychologically. It was like, oh, maybe it was a pretty decent movie. And people going, yeah, it was a great movie, blah, 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 blah. Like, that was good medicine for me.
Well, it really is good to meet the fans because, like I said, in this genre, they're incredibly generous and encouraging and enthusiastic. And we try and share that on the show here.
Here's one more piece of fan art. A little stand for Little.
A beautiful pumpkin-headed figure, the kid with the mask. Yeah,
little buddy. And one more piece of merch from, I believe this is Trick or Treat also. This is the only one I've ever just wanted. And so they sent it to me. A Ouija
board from Halloween.
Can you believe that?
That's great.
Unbelievable.
Beautiful stuff. Well, we've both been involved in sequels and the like. Half my career. That tightrope that I talked about in the opening, I mean, you wrote Amityville 2, you directed Fright Night Part 2, you did Vampires Los Muertos. Tell me about how you feel about that tightrope, about what a sequel is meant to be.
Yeah, I don't know anybody who deals in this world who doesn't have certain mixed feelings about it. I suspect down in your heart somewhere, you share this sense that I have had, which is, okay, on the one hand, this is marvelous. I can't wait to get started. I can somehow carry on this tradition, Fright Night being a good example. I loved that movie and thought, oh, what fun. I can carry on that idea. On the other hand, sequels, from the beginning, as sequelitis started to take over the world, I've had mixed feelings about it. There's a negative connotation with them as being, okay, a cheap knockoff of the original, go through the same steps and just repeat a bunch of tropes and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, mixed feelings, no doubt about that. But also, I think that it's incumbent on any director or writer who takes one on that they better not take it if it's just for the money, if it's just to feed the kids. You really better hold back unless you can embrace it and get excited about it.
Yeah, making a movie is so difficult. It's your whole life for 6 months or a year. Yeah. And if you can't be passionate about it, if you can't love it and instill it with everything that's in your heart, then pass.
Don't do it. It'll tear you up. It's true. Yeah. Or it'll turn you into sort of a zombie. There are plenty of people out there who just jumped in without a sense of direction or a sense of why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Oh, I want to do it because I want to have my face on the cover of something and I want to get money. That's really not a good enough reason.
No, even to go into the business, people who want to become a screenwriter or a filmmaker because they'll be rich and famous, boy, have a big waking up to do.
Oh, yeah. And what's the song? And all the stars that never were are parking cars and pumping gas.
Dionne Warwick, yep.
Yeah, man, it's the truth. The Southern California is littered with those folks. everywhere you look. And a lot of them went back home and found something better to do.
Yeah. So of the sequels that you've done, what were the ones that you were able to get the most excited about? And
I'll mention a couple that you didn't. I actually did a reboot of Flipper.
I know, the TV series.
The TV series did a couple of episodes, the pilot episode, and I think one or two other ones. That was fun.
My wife's grandfather was in the original Flipper movie in Florida.
And what was the other one? Oh, Born Free. I did a reboot of Born Free.
For television.
For television, another one of those forays. Honestly, as sequels go, true sequels, where you're actually echoing whatever came before as opposed to Halloween 3.
Right.
I'm proudest, I think, of Fright Night Part 2.
Yeah.
Most people haven't even seen it because it was like star-crossed. Its release was marred by a double murder. Yeah, I don't know if you know this story.
No, please.
You've heard of the Menendez brothers.
Sure.
Kyle and Lyle or something like that. Lyle and somebody. Anyway, the Menendez brothers murdered their parents, shotgun murdered their parents at Beverly Hills. Well, as it happened, their father, Jose Menendez, was the distribution captain of Fright Night Part 2.
And
he was shotgunned to death several days before it was supposed to be released. It just devastated the whole momentum of the movie in every way. So those guys murdered my movie as well as their parents.
Yikes.
Yeah, that's a terrible story. But it's a beautiful movie, and I'm very proud of it. And the people who have seen it, most of them really feel it's a good, legitimate companion piece to the original.
Sure.
I have nothing but respect for that original. It's a great Tom Holland classic movie. Just a beautiful job, Chris Sarandon and all the rest.
Yeah, the cast is great, and Roddy McDowell. Yeah.
It was a pleasure to have to work with Billy Ragsdale and Roddy McDowell. They were just wonderful. So I'd say that's my favorite.
Well, you and I both took a hard right turn into television for years in our careers too. Yours very, very varied. Some of it TV movies, miniseries. Some of it series. I mean, you did Max Headroom, the original Max Headroom, with one of my favorite human beings.
That was a joy and a pleasure.
Matt Frewer, yeah.
And Matt, I got to work with Matt again on a story called Far From Home, which very young Drew Barrymore was in as well. Matt's a pleasure.
I've worked with Matt more than any other actor.
Yeah, have you? Isn't he a great guy?
He's just the greatest. But you also did the 80s reboot of The Twilight Zone.
That's right. That's right. Another sequel, technically, you could say.
Technically, yeah. So would you say you're particularly drawn to this genre, or that's kind of where you ended up?
I was not highly motivated the way John was. John was laser focused on getting where he wanted to go as a film director. He placed no value on his writing, although I think he's a very good writer.
Sure.
But he would write just to achieve something. I remember astonishment. During my first year out there, I would go up. John had an apartment in Hollywood with two other fellow USC people. They were just getting out and heading off into the industry to try to make their way. And one Friday, John had a conversation with someone who said they had a connection to money, but they needed a script and blah, 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 this and that and the other. And he says, "Oh, I've got the perfect script. I'll see you on Monday." Well, he didn't have any script. He went home. And I was up there at their apartment that weekend, and I watched him sequester himself and write an entire screenplay that weekend. And it should have been crap. It should have been utter dreck. It was called Hillbillies from Hell. And it was really fun and interesting and not bad at all as a screenplay goes. And he showed up with it on Monday. And that was when I knew, my God, this man is motivated.
He's got what it takes.
Yeah, I can't pretend to have been that highly motivated in my own career. I think I bounced around from opportunity to opportunity as it popped up. I was very naive to think that, oh, I got a lot of talent, so this whole thing is going to find me. And it's like, it wasn't until later I realized, wait a minute, everybody out here has got a lot of talent. Everybody out here is looking to score in some way. They may not find you, you know? You may have to try a little harder. I was always more laid back and sort of hippie-fied about the whole thing.
Yes, Kentucky hippie, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much, by way of Ohio.
So did you, were you attracted to the horror genre in particular? Or was that John's influence?
That was John's influence. Not to say I didn't have my favorites, but they were, let's see, two double features stick in my mind. And John will appreciate that I saw one at the Capitol Theater and one at the State Theater, which were the two prominent theaters on our town square.
Right. I've actually been there.
So, you know, the science fiction double feature that knocked me over was 12 to the Moon and Battle in Outer Space.
Wow.
And the horror double feature that blew me away was The Killer Shrews and the Giant Gila Monster. These are, you know, to look at them now, they're almost jokes. They're really of their time.
I remember being a child and in the back of our station wagon at the drive-in and seeing the trailer to The Killer Shrews and dying to see it and knowing I'd never get.
It was. Dogs in shrew suits, exactly. It was ridiculous. But man, you know, you're sitting in there in theater getting all worked up and the music playing and everything. That was when I started to understand. I was a rank amateur compared to John, though. I mean, he was wild about horror movies, especially, but sci-fi as well. So much so that he started his own fan magazine when he was still pretty young.
Wow.
He was a creative dynamo. My life changed when we made friends for real as teenagers. We'd been aware of each other since grade school. We were both in a K through 12 school right there on the campus of Western Kentucky University.
Where his father was a professor.
Yes. And we were both in the orchestra. I was on trombone. He was on violin. Wow. And we took private lessons, violin for him, piano for me. So that by the time we really, it was an orchestra trip when our friendship was sealed. He was in the back. He brought his guitar. He was playing. And all these girls were gathered around him. And it was like, wait a minute. This guy's onto something, you know.
So this had to be the birth of the Coupe de Villes.
Well, it was the birth of us singing together and then starting to sing John's songs and then forming a rock and roll garage cover band that we actually made a lot of money for a couple of years in high school and early college. And then the Coupe de Villes gelled once John was in USC cinema, because he was he had that rare talent to come up with a song or a theme or even an entire score for student films, whereas most of us were forced to use like the latest Cat Stevens number behind our you know, whatever was available. But John was supplying people with original music. And I started helping him, and that's when Nick appeared, Nick Castle.
Nick Castle, yeah. The two of you were both the shape, yeah.
Yeah, indeed. You could say Nick was the long range and smooth walking shape, and I was the guy who broke stuff.
The heavy handed one. Well, we can't go through your television work without coming to It, especially for this show. It and the success of the original It on ABC led to The Stand, which I did. And so that never would have happened had it not been for your first trip with Pennywise.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I have such fond memories of that show. And I believe its great secret weapon was the casting between these heavyweight TV stars as the adults and these wonderful children who, I think the secret of that casting was that we got right was I truly believed those kids growing up to be those adults. And that's, you know very well, it's not an easy thing to pull off, is that sense of, okay, here's this kid. And then next scene, you're looking at the adult and going, yeah, I see that. They look like they could have grown up to be that person. And I also think that holds true generally for Stephen King. Everybody talks about horror and the scary situations he creates, but I don't think he would have endured as long as he has without other elements at work. And the key element to my mind is he has tapped into childhood in a way that resonates with anyone who reads his stuff. It's just the rites of passage and the secrets and the bonding that take place. And it comes up again and again and again. I remember being bowled over when I saw Stand By Me.
Oh, one of the best movies ever.
Ever. Such a good job Rob Reiner did, and all of them did on that show. But that, again, these are the rites of passage of childhood. And Stephen King just had his fingers all over the pulse of that. And I think that's what made our original It really tick, that we got that part right.
That's for sure. So, it has lasted so long. There are still people who prefer it to the movies that have come out.
Yeah, people come up and tell me that. I really have to take a look at the new one. I don't have anything against it. It's sitting on my stack of stuff to watch. I didn't plunge right in to watch it though, because there was one thing about it that struck me as a missed note. When I see Tim Curry in the early scenes in my It, he is someone I could believe a child would approach because he's charming.
Right.
And his makeup is neutral. In the new It, I see a clown who's made up in such a way that he looks scary. He looks scary. I think to myself, no child in their right mind would go near that thing. And I think that they may have over-revved their, who am I to say? It's a successful movie, so more power to them. But
well, it's such a bizarre experience. You know, they remade The Stand recently, and watching that was just an otherworldly experience. It's really hard because you live it for so long.
Yeah.
In your version.
It's your baby.
Yeah. And then suddenly it's like, wow, this is completely different. And
yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. But I love seeing how someone else takes on the same story and creates something totally different.
Yeah. Yeah, it amazes me. I suppose Halloween is a great example of not only did The Shape just never die, but the franchise never dies.
Until the new one, apparently.
Well, I don't believe it for a second. I had a conversation with Mustafa Akkad some years before he was killed. I'm sure you know that story.
He was
murdered in the Middle East by terrorists.
Yeah, this is the original executive producer of the original Halloween. Yeah.
Yes. And I said, Mustafa, good God, man, haven't you made enough money? Aren't you ever gonna end this? And he said, Michael Myers will never die. It was just like, yeah, no matter how many times you kill him, they're gonna bring him back until they've squeezed every dollar out of him.
Evil never dies.
Yeah.
Evil. No. Well, look, the Friday the 13th, how many decades ago was the final chapter?
Right, exactly. I mean, it's a little like, who are the perennial, like Cher, how many farewell tours?
Yeah.
You know, it just keeps on going. It's never going to stop. Elton
John. As long as the audience wants it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Elton John's 14th farewell tour.
Yeah, something like that. So as far as the job of director goes, what is the part of it that you're the most passionate about or that you enjoy the most? Is it interacting with the actors? Is it being on set? Is it putting out fires? Is it writing, rewriting? Is it shot listing? Is it editing? Is it sound mix? There's so many parts to the slices of the pie.
Well, Mick, you've done the checklist, and I have to say, and done them very well, by the way, because those are the biggies, the big categories.
Thank you.
For me, it started out because I didn't come out of the theater. I came out of graphic design and art. It started out being a sort of calculated movement of shapes in the frame. That is to say the Alfred Hitchcock approach, very careful storyboarding, psychological implications of starting wide and pushing in close and all that. All that was what I was most caught up in, was shot making. But it didn't take that long to understand that if you want a really top quality movie, you better get with those actors and work with them and give them a safe space and build them up to where they feel safe and where they feel confident that they can make mistakes, they can try things, which of course is difficult on a tight schedule, but you've got to find a way to at least make everybody feel that way, that, oh, we got all the time in the world. But of course it's not true, but if the actors feel that way, they'll give you more. So I'd have to say that it has evolved, I hope, from being all about the graphics to being all about the performances and mixing and matching in between according to what scene it is.
And there's another thing people don't really associate with you, but And the Sea Will Tell, the adaptation of Vincent Bugliosi's book, was something particularly special, especially when it came to the performances. Tell me a little about that.
I really appreciate your bringing it up, because people do ask me what's the movie you're proudest of, and I'll vacillate between it and The Sea Will Tell, because they actually were back to back. As soon as I got off it, I went on to And the Sea Will Tell. Green, Epstein, and Bacino were the producers, and boy, you couldn't ask for better support. That's part of the reason when a director has that kind of support, you can really work out. But it was an ideal situation, not to mention getting to go to Tahiti and Hawaii, based in Vancouver. That's a dream come true.
That'll take
it. Yeah, that'll put you in a good mood. But thank you for that. The performances actually didn't come that easily. Richard Crenna was the perfect example of the perfect actor's actor. He just showed up, didn't require much in the way of, all I had to do was say, Richard, as far as I can tell, you're doing exactly what I'm hoping for. So maybe I should be giving you a bunch of direction, but I don't have anything to say. Just do your thing.
Yeah.
Whereas Rachel Ward and Hart Bochner playing the parts of the bad guys, you could say, in a way, they were a handful every day. I don't know whether it was they felt in order to get the performances they needed, they had to be us against the world. That would fit. that's a theory I have anyway, that one reason they made themselves kind of difficult to work with was that they just needed that to get off into their performances, which I think in both cases were terrific.
Yeah, they were.
But they didn't come easily, you know. They cost us. It was difficult. It was so difficult that Richard Crenna one day just took me aside. He said, "I don't see how you're doing this. I want to punch those two in the face every time I see them."
And he's a guy who has also directed. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess I can say that because Richard's gone on to heaven and actors' heaven. And and Rachel and Hart both knew that I didn't feel that great about how they treated the crew. It's one thing, you know, to have a method that causes you to maybe, like Tim Curry, Tim stayed away kind of from the other actors and from really the crew. He had a great sense of humor. And if you approached him, he was amiable, but he also stood off to one side most of the time. And since that's the only time I worked with Tim, I don't know whether that was typical or whether it was part of him being Pennywise and remaining aloof to help his performance and perhaps help the others as well by being not so familiar with
him. Yeah, every actor has a different approach to how they work. Exactly. And that's what you have to learn early on when you're doing a shoot as the director is.
Is that not the biggest conundrum when one of your actors in scenes where they're both appearing all the time, what if one of them hates to rehearse and in fact is best on take one without rehearsal and the other one needs about 12 takes to get warmed up?
You find that out very quickly.
Isn't that something? It really is a conundrum that I still don't know how you do that except to just do a lot of takes and make sure you're, like, as you point out, make sure you're covering the critical one, their best angle and their best shot early if they're that kind of actor, or late if they're that other kind of actor.
Yeah, some take time to ramp up. Well,
and if you want to do it as a one-er,
good luck.
Good luck. Yeah.
Well, Tommy Lee, thank you so much. This is our Halloween month, so we're doing four shows this month all about Halloween, and we could not do it without putting a big spotlight on Halloween 3, and it's been a total pleasure.
Well, Mick, you've been so kind and so insightful. Thank you for the good questions. Really a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, it takes two. At least. You.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.